I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A 300-foot column of fire soared above three well-guarded, gated communities in the Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh last night in a well-choreographed assault by suicide bombers. The latest numbers indicate that at least 91 people are dead, including at least seven Americans. Secretary of State Colin Powell arrived in Riyadh today to meet with Saudi officials. His trip had been planned before the attacks. He said the strike has the earmarks of Al-Qaeda. President Bush, speaking in Indianapolis earlier today, said that these despicable acts were committed by killers whose only faith is hate. He said the United States will find the killers and that they will learn the meaning of American justice. Joining me now on the line from Saudi Arabia is John Bradley, managing editor of Arab News. Thanks for speaking with us, John.
You're welcome.
John, conflicting reports on just what happened here. Can you tell us what you know?
What happened is that last night at about 11:20 p.m. local time, three bombs went off simultaneously. Suicide bombers had packed cars with explosives, and they'd driven to three different residential compounds. When they reached them, they opened fire with Kalashnikovs and then stormed the gate. They drove the cars into the most densely populated area of each residential compound, and then blew themselves up.
Do we know, then, how many suicide bombers were involved?
It seems to be nine. They found there was an announcement earlier that nine charred bodies had been found, and they were presumed to be the suicide hijackers.
How surprising is it to you that the security at these gated compounds would have been breached?
You have two choices. Either you can live in a prison and guarantee that this kind of thing won't happen, or you can try and live a normal life and you can never really 100% guard against such fanatics. I mean, you've only got to look at Israel. It's got some of the most secure borders in the world. It's on a constant state of high alert, and yet suicide bombers manage to penetrate into the very heart of their major cities and detonate their explosives. When someone turns up at a compound and they open fire with Kalashnikovs, and then they ram the gate, and they're determined to blow themselves up and cause as much death and misery as possible, there's only so much that any security force can do in such circumstances. Obviously, the only thing that they can do is to have intelligence which would allow them to intercept before the attacks took place. And obviously, the evidence would seem to suggest that that intelligence information was not available.
How shaken is the foreign community there, John?
The expat community is very, very shaken, but it was coming. We've had repeated warnings of an imminent al-Qaeda attack. The U.S. State Department just 1 week ago issued a very clear warning and guidance saying that Americans should not travel to Saudi Arabia and private citizens should consider leaving Saudi Arabia. In fact, last night when the news broke, very late here for our newspaper, we had to take a story off page 2 of Arab News because it was explaining the latest Australian government advice, which was that an al-Qaeda attack was imminent and that Australians should take care. So it was in the air, and there's been a lot of tension here with the U.S.-led war in Iraq, with the Palestinian Intifada, with the U.S. troop issue. Although we're all horrified and shocked, there is a sort of surreal sense here that what everyone was thinking would have happened a long time ago has finally happened.
John Bradley, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
John Bradley's the managing editor of Arab News. He joined us from Jeddah in Saudi Arabia.
The warnings. Well, shortly after the bombings, Robert Jordan, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, spoke to Britain's Sky News.
There's certainly a great deal of suspicion that al-Qaeda is involved. Some of our preliminary indications of a couple of weeks ago, upon which we warned travelers, indicated that al-Qaeda members were in final stages of preparation for an attack against Western interests.
That warning on May 1st was unusually specific. Then on May 6th, Saudi intelligence forces launched what turned out to be a botched raid on a group said to have al-Qaeda links. 19 suspected terrorists escaped. Joining us on the line from Arlington, Virginia, is Roger Cressy. He's a former deputy for counterterrorism on the National Security Council staff. And, Roger, have last night's bombings been definitely tied to al-Qaeda or to the suspects who escaped last week's Saudi raid?
Well, Robin, it certainly has all the hallmarks of an al-Qaeda operation. Multiple simultaneous attacks, well-planned, well-coordinated, going after soft targets, and looking to get a high body count. That is part of al-Qaeda's MO, and it looks like they accomplished it last night.
Well, Saudi authorities are saying that their raid, in which, as I said, 19 suspects escaped, and in which they seized weapons and explosives, that raid foiled terrorist strikes. It's early on, but does last night's bombing contradict that?
Well, there's certainly a couple possibilities here. One is that this was a straight-out al-Qaeda attack, that the 19 who escaped were, in fact, responsible for last night's attack, or it could be a separate and distinct cell, another group of individuals not associated with the 19 who were able to find and use a different weapons cache to conduct this attack.
Which is, of course, a bigger problem.
Absolutely. Even if it was the 19 that escaped that were responsible for last night, the more disturbing point is the Saudis found a weapons cache of several hundred pounds of explosives, automatic weapons, and grenades, which they seized just a few days ago. Now these individuals were able to find a separate weapons cache. And so the question we all have to ask ourselves now is, how many safe houses are there inside Saudi Arabia that Islamic terrorists can use, not only to plan, but to use weapons and explosives that are available to them there?
Isn't there also a question about how that raid could have been botched so badly?
Well, you do kind of have to question the idea that if this safe house was under surveillance by the Saudis for a period of time, how the raid could go so badly and all 19 could escape. That's not to say the Saudis opened up the back door to them, but it does suggest a lack of planning and execution on their part.
Is this a predictable next step for Osama bin Laden? His list of complaints included U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia, which are being removed. He complained about the secular leaders in the region. Now Saddam Hussein has been removed. And then thirdly, the royal family in Saudi Arabia. So is this the beginning of the attempt by al-Qaeda to remove them?
Well, actually, the attempt has been going on for several years now. There have been a number of attacks that have been foiled by the Saudis against the royal family. U.S.-Saudi cooperation has broken up several plots and several cells. So this has been going on for some time. But al-Qaeda's view on Saudi Arabia is pretty straightforward. One, they want the United States off the peninsula in general. And two, they want to overthrow the House of Saud, because they believe the royal family are illegitimate custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina. So even if the United States, in fact, reduces or eliminates its military presence in Saudi, al-Qaeda is still going to go after the royal family.
One last question. What do you think the future holds? More attacks, and how soon, and how big?
Well, a lot of people were patting themselves on the back in recent weeks because we have not had a significant attack in some time. But that's not for a lack of trying on al-Qaeda's part. Plots have been broken up in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Asia over the past 18 months. So what you saw last night in Riyadh, you're going to see more of, unfortunately. They're sophisticated, they're well-trained, and more importantly, al-Qaeda is extremely persistent. And it's just a very good reminder to everyone that the war on terrorism is not something that's going to be over anytime soon.
Roger Cressy, thank you.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Roger Cressy, former deputy for counterterrorism on the National Security Council staff.
Terrorist attacks are not new in Saudi Arabia. In 1996, a tanker truck loaded with fuel exploded outside the Khobar Towers, a military housing complex in Dhahran. The bomb killed 19 Americans and wounded 372 others. There have also been many lesser-known attacks in the kingdom, car bombs, and attacks on individuals. To get more on the background on terrorism in Saudi Arabia, we now turn to Jeremy Binney, Middle East editor for Jane's Sentinel Security Assessments in London. And Jeremy, let's start with the Khobar Towers attack of 1996. Who was behind that? Do we know?
I don't mean there's an official verdict on it at all. Initially, the finger was pointed fairly much firmly in Iran's direction, but Saudi Arabia is so closely associated with radical Islam and terrorism that increasingly it looks like this might have been launched by an al-Qaeda group of some description.
How content were U.S. officials with Saudi cooperation in that investigation?
Not at all, as reports have it. The FBI people who were sent over did not find them very cooperative at all, and it was a real problem with the investigation, apparently. The Saudis didn't want really the truth to come out in this matter. They just wanted to sweep it under the carpet, basically.
Khobar Tower is the most spectacular terrorist attack in Saudi Arabia, perhaps, before the one last night. But there have been many smaller attacks in the kingdom.
Yeah, over the last couple of years, there have been these attacks on Westerners in Saudi Arabia. But the Saudis were keen to project an image of the world that these attacks were perpetrated by Westerners on Westerners as they battled to control the illegal alcohol trade. This view was never believed by any of the expats in Saudi Arabia, not really by any of us in the observer community. We've always suspected that Islamic militants would be responsible for these attacks against Westerners. And we're talking about relatively sophisticated car bombs, etc. And there have also been an increasing number of shootings as well in Saudi Arabia. But this sort of level of insecurity is increasing, definitely. And there have also been attacks on Saudi officials, such as police officers. The situation there is certainly getting worse.
Well, how hard have the Saudis cracked down on it?
It's sometimes hard to tell because information coming out of Saudi Arabia is sketchy, and the officials really like to put the best face on it they possibly can. But it certainly seems that they're taking it much more seriously now. Some of the areas are now almost under military rule, with checkpoints everywhere, and certain towns which have had anti-US protests, etc., having a very significant security force presence. They are beginning to sort of develop momentum of sort of uncovering the networks, and it can turn into a bit of a landslide if you begin to catch enough key people. But at the same time, it depends a lot on the strength of these terrorist networks inside Saudi Arabia, and we just don't know at this stage.
How vulnerable is the royal family? Could they fall?
It's an interesting question. A lot of people have talked about this, that they must inevitably fall at some time, especially if they continue their current policies, which basically it's a family-run country. And for any of the subjects that they rule, this situation should be unacceptable. There are no family funds and state funds. It's all basically family. It's all merged into one. So it's incredibly hard to get any sort of transparency out of how Saudi Arabia is run as a country. And so there's a growing wave of opposition to that. And also the economic situation is deteriorating, despite it being the wealthiest oil country in the world. The GDP per capita is decreasing. One of the reasons for this is that there are so many royals. The list runs into thousands, and they all demand such a lot of money from the oil revenues that they are just actually draining the country of its wealth, just this one family. So there is a lot more pressure to change. And now, if they continue to dig their heels in and don't sort of instigate a gradual reform process, at some stage, there will be violent change.
Jeremy Binney, thanks very much.
No problem.
Jeremy Binney is Middle East editor for Jane's Sentinel Security Assessments. He joined us from London.
And we have this update. The State Department now says the death toll in the Riyadh explosions is closer to the Saudi government estimate of 29 total dead, not 91, as the State Department reported.
Stay with us. There's more ahead coming up here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. There'll be more on the attack in Saudi Arabia coming up on BBC News at 1 o'clock. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by the Pine Hills, featuring a wide range of single-family homes, townhomes, and custom homes in Plymouth and online at pinehills.com. By Sudbury Granite and Marble, direct importer and fabricator of granite and marble surfaces for homes in Boston, the Cape, and the Islands, in Sudbury, Mendon, and West Hartford, Connecticut. Connecticut, and by Mississippi's of Roxbury, delivering hot lunches and sandwiches for groups of 10 or more. Menus at mississippis.com. In the forecast, mostly cloudy and breezy with a chance of afternoon showers today, highs near 60. Cloudy, showers tonight, lows around 49. Tomorrow and Thursday both look partly sunny and breezy with highs around 60. It's 61 degrees under mostly cloudy skies right now in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Even in these uncertain economic times, post the dot-com bubble, we mean, there are still lots of technology meetings that draw together the bright lights and big thinkers of the Internet world. One of the most interesting is the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference in Santa Clara, California. That's according to David Weinberger, our regular InfoTech commentator who's just returned from the O'Reilly, as they call it in the biz. So, David, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And what does this mean, Emerging Technology Conference? I mean, it would seem like it would be what it sounds like.
And it is. It's a place where people who are deeply into the technology get to talk with one another and see what they're thinking, see what's going to be emerging.
What's emerging. Yeah. And what were the hot topics?
Well, oddly, emergence itself was maybe the hottest topic.
What does that mean, emergence?
Stuff is emergent if you can get very complex behavior out of very simple rules. The standard example is the behavior of ants. Ants are relatively stupid, but they do some pretty intelligent things, like organize themselves into highly efficient bucket brigades to bring back the food that they've seemingly quite intelligently found and lined up and organized like an army, whereas we're pretty sure that there is no higher intelligence directing this. Or wasps making very complex nests, or termites building 12-foot structures.
They're just swarming, but there's something going on there.
Yes, very simple little animals that apparently if you give them extremely simple rules, rules so simple that even an ant could follow them, you get exactly this complex and organized behavior.
So how do simple brains translate to the Internet?
Well, it's all over the place. I mean, that's what was interesting to me about the conference. So the computer programmers are at the conference, and right now computer programs, if you want a computer to do something complex, you write 100,000, a million, 2 million lines of code. An ant does something pretty complex. It has much less code than that. So are there techniques we can learn from nature about how to be more efficient computer programmers?
Okay.
But also, one of the pervasive topics at this conference was this relatively new category of software called social software. And the idea is that after 10 years of companies investing in very complex software solutions for managing their business and enabling people to work together, much of which has not performed to expectation, maybe much simpler software that allows people to organize themselves as they want to will work better.
Give me an idea of how that might work.
Well, maybe the simplest example is email itself, which was designed to do something that's extremely simple, which is send a message from me to you, but has ended up being used by people to do much more complex things, to organize entire projects and tasks by using mailing lists and attachments to move documents through a review process. So those features, so to speak, of email emerged directly from people's needs. Nobody told them, you must use email in this way.
Can you look into the future and see another example?
Well, there's one that's become actually quite popular that's very weird. It's called Wikis, W-I-K-I. Apparently, it means easy or simple in Hawaiian, but that may be an urban myth for all I know. Yeah. A wiki is a plain and simple web page, all text, that anybody can edit, which sounds like a terrible idea because it means you may spend 4 hours writing up this beautiful report on this page and somebody else comes along and edits it by deleting it or adding curses or just being stupid on it.
Right. And by the way, we have many listeners and we hear from them all the time who don't go online very often. And so we should explain that usually when you go onto the web, there's information there, but you can't change it. But you're saying you would be able to change it at its home base?
Yes, you'd be able to change it, and that's the page that is posted and public to either the big public on the Internet or maybe just to your work group.
That does sound like a terrible idea, though, doesn't it?
It sounds like a terrible idea. It turns out to be actually not such a bad idea. Maybe the best example of that is the Wikipedia.
Okay.
Which was an experiment that has turned out extraordinarily well. You can go to wikipedia.com. It's an online encyclopedia that has been written by strangers. Anybody can edit any entry. If you have a field of expertise, you know something about some topic, and the topic isn't covered. I think there are 200,000 topics covered, but if one isn't, you can write it up. If somebody comes along and disagrees with you or has additional information, she or he can then change the page.
Well, as usual, as things go with the Internet, it's trusting that the person who changes it does know better. It's trusting that, for instance, you wouldn't have a professor's paper and some student wants to make the professor look bad, so they come in and they change it.
That's exactly the prediction that many people had, why this thing just wouldn't work. But it turns out that it has worked. And there's a cadre of people. Now, this is part of the self-organization. It turned out there needs to be a cadre of people who have special permissions. And if somebody goes in and trashes a page, this cadre can turn the page back to where it was.
Uh-oh, that's what everyone fears, the beginning of a hierarchy on the Internet.
Well, yes, but that's the question, how much organization needs to emerge. What's the minimal amount of organization that needs to emerge in order to enable the greater success?
Well, we will keep an eye on those topics. But what else did you see? What caught your eye at the convention?
The Internet Bookmobile was pretty impressive.
What's that?
It's a project that takes 1 million public domain books, digitizes them so they're available on a computer, puts them on a little van and sends the van around. So you can go in, you can pick any of the 1 million books, and they'll print it out for you for a buck. And it's a nice-looking paperback copy, by the way.
And the proceeds go to them. Is that legal?
Because they're in the public domain,
that's right.
Absolutely. But this is a nonprofit operation, and it's spread, for example, to India that just put in place 30 of these Internet bookmobiles.
Wow. Isn't this kind of expensive?
The fascinating statistic, or maybe it's just a factoid from the guy who gave the presentation, is studies show that it costs $2 just to check a book in and out of a library. And here he's printing one off for a buck. There's no check-in fee, and you get to keep the book.
It's so funny that here you are talking about emerging technologies and we end up with a book.
Well, it's a good way of delivering information.
Yes, it is. So. Well, David, thank you.
Thank you.
David Weinberger, Here and Now's Internet commentator and philosopher. For more, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the Speaker of the House in Texas wants 53 of his Democratic colleagues rounded up and, well, arrested. We get the lowdown on why they're presently holed up at a Holiday Inn in Oklahoma.
And Kathy Guntz prepares fiddleheads, the coiled fern leaves that are a delicacy this time of year. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Skinner Auctioneers, currently accepting antiques, including furniture, paintings, and jewelry, for its summer and fall auction seasons. Auction schedule online at SkinnerInc.com. By Salem 5 Commercial Banking, offering a full range of financial products to meet commercial business and real estate needs, 888-662-5500, or DirectBanking.com. And by Bistro 5 in West Medford Square, featuring eclectic Tuscan cuisine and highlighted in the current Zagat survey, titled Spotlight on America's Top Restaurants. It's 61 degrees right now in Boston, under mostly cloudy skies, looking for showers this afternoon.
What makes a Citizens of the World tour special?
We had wonderful meals in exotic places, had incredible accommodations.
It was exciting and it was fun, and we got unbelievable treatment and unbelievable accommodations and food and everything. It was really a great time.
Join Sylvia Pagioli on our next Citizens of the World tour, exploring the art and culture of Italy this summer. You'll see Michelangelo's David in Florence, enjoy a wine tasting at Tuscany's most respected winery, quiet nights at the luxurious Palazzo Terranova near Florence, and much more. For information, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community. On the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, the California debate over whether college professors and their students should be allowed to date.
The problem is that students really should be in a relationship that's a professional teacher-student relationship. Romantic or sexual relationships undermine that basic professional one.
And a talk with writer and director Neil LaBute about cruelty, love, and art in his new film, The Shape of Things.
I'm a cross of P.T. Barnum and the Marquis de Sade.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. U.S. officials say the death toll from yesterday's terrorist attack in Saudi Arabia is 29, including 9 attackers. A Saudi official says 7 Americans are among the dead. Secretary of State Colin Powell had put that number at 10, but now says it could be lower.
These are people who are determined to try to penetrate facilities like this for the purpose of killing people in their sleep, killing innocent people, killing people who would try to help others. And notwithstanding what you see here today and the damage you see here today, it will not deter the United States, and I'm sure it will not deter Saudi Arabia in our mutual effort to go after this kind of terrorism and to roll it up.
Yesterday, attackers shot their way into 3 compounds that house foreign workers in Riyadh and set off multiple car bombs. President Bush is denouncing the terrorist attacks in Saudi Arabia as despicable and vowing those responsible will be brought to justice. At a rally for his tax cut plans in Indianapolis, the president called the attacks ruthless murder. New developments in Iraq today. The temporary Iraqi health ministry chief, handpicked by the U.S. officials, resigned just 10 days into the job after widespread protests due to his close ties to Saddam Hussein. U.S. forces found another trailer in northern Iraq that appeared to be a mobile biological weapons lab, according to Pentagon officials. A number of Cuban diplomats are being expelled from the U.S. for alleged spying. Officials have ordered 7 workers at Cuba's Manhattan-based U.N. mission to leave the country, as well as several others from Cuban interests in Washington. Cuba tightened restrictions on travel by American diplomats in Havana 2 months ago. The State Department responded by placing similar constraints on Cubans in Washington. A Palestinian official says it seems that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon did not read the roadmap for peace. The Palestinian is warning that the violence will not stop unless Jewish settlements are removed from the West Bank. As President Bush prepares to meet with South Korea's new leader, a U.S. military source is claiming that North Korea aimed a laser at a U.S. helicopter. The source says the incident happened in March when the helicopter picked up a laser signal, but no damage was reported. Researchers in Germany may have found a possible treatment for the deadly SARS virus, according to the journal Science. German scientists there tentatively identified the structure of the SARS protein that infects cells and believe it may be vulnerable to an experimental drug. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, supporting the fight against cancer in the American Cancer Society's Relay for Life, 800-ACS-2345. The Lenox Hotel in Boston's Back Bay, recipient of AAA's 4 Diamond Award and the American Hotel Association's Environmental Hotel of the Year Award 2000. And by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialist. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future, techfusion.com, where data is never lost. In the forecast, a mostly cloudy and breezy afternoon with afternoon showers likely, highs around 60. Tonight, cloudy, a chance of showers, lows around 49. Both tomorrow and the next day look partly sunny and breezy with highs around 60. Right now, it's 61 degrees under mostly cloudy skies in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
To date or not to date, your college student, that is. This is the question professors at the University of California are expected to vote on this spring. A dating policy in the UC system would make it the latest institution to ban relations between professors and students. And it would come in the wake of a sex scandal at UC Berkeley's Bolt Law School, whose dean recently stepped down amid accusations he sexually molested a student. Supporters of the policy hope it will prevent the many complications, legal and otherwise, that arise from such liaisons, but critics consider it an intrusion into personal and private lives. Joining us on the line is Gail Binion. She's professor of political science at UC Santa Barbara and chair of UC's Academic Senate. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you.
Gail, you support a ban on professor-student dating. How come?
Well, to tell you the truth, I thought we did have a ban. Some of us were very surprised to find out that we didn't have a policy. And our policy actually, if it's adopted, will be very mainstream, and it will ban dating between faculty and their own students. This wouldn't be a ban on any faculty member dating any student.
Uh-huh. Why the need now for such a clearly delineated ban?
Well, as I said, many of us believed that there was a ban because we had adopted a statement to that effect about 20 years ago, but apparently it never made its way into formal code of conduct policy. The problem is that students really should be in a relationship that's a professional teacher-student relationship. And romantic or sexual relationships undermine that basic professional one.
So do you oppose any professor-student relationship or only relationships where a student is actually being taught by that professor?
Well, we use the dividing line of academic supervision. So if a student is enrolled in your class or a student is your PhD student whose dissertation or other work you're overseeing, or if a student is an assistant in your lab, those are all forms of academic supervision, and that's where the policy would prohibit the sexual relationship.
Aren't you kind of dreaming that you're going to be able to really stop attraction between human beings?
Nobody says you're stopping attraction. We're talking about behavior. We're talking about ethical conduct.
Yeah, but won't you just drive it underground if a professor and a student are attracted to each other?
Well, I'm not sure that's the case. I think most faculty not only have just assumed there was such a policy all these years, but most faculty live by that standard because it is inappropriate conduct. So will we drive it underground? Well, I don't think this will drive it underground. If it's going on now, it is probably underground already. Nobody openly admits to engaging in this conduct at UC.
Nobody at UC openly admits to dating a professor?
You won't find a faculty member. This policy doesn't cover students. This policy covers faculty members.
What would the sanction be under the dating policy if you were caught?
Most charges under the code of conduct wind up being resolved administratively. If they can't be resolved administratively, which means it doesn't go to being a case. And if it can't be resolved administratively, charges can be brought to the Privilege and Tenure Committee. If the Privilege and Tenure Committee recommends sanction, there's a range of sanctions. I think we have 6 different levels of sanction. Something can be as minor as a letter of objection to the person's behavior all the way to being fired. I don't know that anyone would be fired for this kind of conduct. I think it's highly unlikely. But I do think that if we have the policy, department chairs and deans are able to advise their faculty that they're potentially going to be in serious trouble if they don't shape up.
Gail Binion, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Professor Gail Binion teaches political science at UC Berkeley. She's also chair of the school's Academic Senate. Well, one person who does not share Professor Binion's views about these so-called dangerous liaisons is California Professor Barry Dank, who teaches sociology at Cal State Long Beach. He's also the editor-in-chief of Sexuality and Culture. And, Professor, is the ban on student-teacher relationships a good idea?
It's a poor idea. I had to laugh with your introduction about dangerous liaison. My experience, personal and otherwise, they're rather pedestrian liaisons. All too many academics who have promulgated a mythology that it's predatory professors taking advantage of female students. The other side of the coin that some people promulgate, but it's not mentioned in the Berkeley controversy, that it's predatory female students taking advantage of professors. I don't find anything particularly different from student-professor relationships vis-a-vis professor-professor or student-student. In fact, they're quite traditional because in student-professor relationships, generally the male is older. There's nothing particularly controversial about that.
Huh. That's an interesting perspective. Yeah. And you have a particular perspective on this, don't you? Because you did marry one of your former students.
I did marry former student. I met her while she was a student in my class. We dated after the class ended. And then she asked me if I would have a problem with her taking another class from me. I said, absolutely not. As long as you understand, you will be treated just as I treat any other student. You will not be treated differentially. The banners, as I call them, they want to treat female students differentially. In some universities, the rule is that if such a relation occurs, the student must be taken out of the professor's class.
Aren't the banners concerned about kind of an inherent imbalance when a kind of authority figure like a professor begins to become emotionally involved with a usually much younger and perhaps more immature person?
As far as the power differential in terms, you know, my area is study of sexuality, and that is the norm in terms of heterosexual relationships. I would argue that student-professor relationships shouldn't be per se treated differently than any other form of relationship. When I see coercion occurring, whoever is involved, that is a problem. The great injustice that is being done here is the conflation, the confusing of sexual harassment with consensual relationships. It also shocks me that all too many university professors really think that university administrators can make things better by getting involved in these sorts of relationships.
Barry Dank, thank you very much for your interesting point of view on all this.
My pleasure.
Barry Dank is a sociology professor at Cal State Long Beach.
Still to come, talk about relationships. Filmmaker Neil LaBute on his latest relationship film, The Shape of Things.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Every day, 150,000 commuters rush through New York's Grand Central Station at perilous speeds. In the fall, it's hoped they'll do something New Yorkers rarely do, stop at a little booth set up in the train terminal and talk.
Somebody yells to them, "It's a boy!" And they're hugging and kissing. It was like unbelievable. I mean, it was like peace in the world. We were on the United Nations train. I mean, there were everybody there, Chinese, blacks, whites, you name Puerto Rico. Everybody's kissing and hugging. Everybody loved each other for 10 minutes. So I give her the baby. I put the baby on Kathy. I says, "Congratulations, you have a baby boy." I said, "Why don't you name him Charles for the C train? He was born on the C train." She says, "No, what's your name?" I said, "My name's Joe." She said, "Is Joe or Joseph?" I said, "Joseph." She says, "My baby boy is named Joseph because I never would have done this without you." That's when I realized I delivered a baby, and my knees buckled.
It's part of a project set up by oral historian David Isay. NPR listeners are very familiar with David's award-winning documentaries. His goal is to democratize the airwaves, to record the voices of people surviving in the margins. Well, with this new project, he hopes to capture the words of those disembarking from the Metro North. And David joins us on the line to talk about it. Hi, David.
Hi, Robin.
Well, tell us, first of all, what's this project and how would it work?
StoryCorps is the new project here at Sound Portraits, and basically the idea is this. We're going to be building booths, first in Grand Central Station here in New York and at a little synagogue down on the Lower East Side called the Eldridge Street Synagogue, and then across the country. And the idea is that you go to these soundproof booths. There's a facilitator there who we've trained, and you go with your grandmother, your grandfather, someone from your community, whoever you want to take. We train you in how to do an oral history. You go into this booth, and you spend 40 minutes inside doing an interview. You have a question sheet that you've created with us, and you walk away with a broadcast quality CD, and you leave a CD with us, and that becomes part of an oral history of America. Mm. And our dream is to just spread this all over the country. We're going to put these on trucks. We're just going to kind of get everybody talking and listening.
It sounds like sort of a confessional, if you will, a little booth in the middle of
kind of therapy in a box, in one way. But it's also, it's about history. It's about taking the time to just listen to the stories of the people around you. And it's about regular people. It's about celebrating the stories of ordinary folks and not just celebrities in this insane celebrity-focused culture we live in.
Right. You've said that this is the antidote to The Bachelor. But we want to touch base with you as you do this project. But what will your facilitators tell people that will help them do these interviews?
Well, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science. It's just about listening. It's a bit corny, but I actually believe it. We like to say listening is an act of love. And it's just about being curious and being honest. And, you know, in this case, a microphone will give you the, will allow you to sort of give you the permission to ask questions you might normally not get to ask from a family member.
Well, we only have a few seconds, and this is a terribly unfair thing to do to you who spent hours documenting people. But can you tell us, what is the most surprising thing someone has said to you?
You know, to me, everything is everything I hear is surprising. If it's surprising, then it makes it onto the air into our NPR documentaries. I'm always surprised just by the kind of poetry and dignity and strength that you find in the stories of regular people when you take the time to listen to them. So it's kind of constant surprise.
Well, David, thank you and good luck with it.
Thank you, Robin.
David Isay is the founder of Sound Portraits Productions. For more on StoryCorps, visit our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Boston Private Bank and Trust Company, with a commitment to banking and investment services in the tradition of the world's leading private banks, bostonprivatebank.com. By Mirtha Kalina, LLP, a law firm with offices in Boston, Woburn, Hartford, and New Haven, serving the legal needs of businesses and individuals throughout New England, on the web at mirthalaw.com. And by Mississippi's baked sweet potato pie, flourless chocolate cake, peach cobbler, and a dozen other desserts. For a limited time, you can enter our drawing to win the latest model from Subaru, a new Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington. See the new Baja and enter the drawing with your contribution for the news online at WBUR.org. News from the BBC is coming up next at 1 o'clock. In the forecast, mostly cloudy today with showers likely, highs around 61, a damp, cool night. Tomorrow, partly sunny with highs around 60. 61 degrees right now in Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Writer and director Neil LaBute's award-winning films are relentlessly cruel. Maybe that's what makes them so provocative. Not that all of his films are mean-hearted. Nurse Betty wasn't. But the main characters in his first film, In the Company of Men, will go down in film history as two of the most inhuman, vengeful, and damaged guys you'll ever come across on the big screen. These two 30-something mid-level businessmen are fed up with their jobs and with women and decide to get their own sick and twisted revenge on all females by plotting to romance a vulnerable woman and then dump her viciously without explanation.
I mean, think about it. No, right. I mean, it's funny. It is. It's just way out there.
Sure. And that's why it's so perfect. I mean, this is all virgin territory. And no matter what happens after it, you know, jumped over for promotions, wife runs off with some biochemist, I mean, who knows what. But we would always have this thing to fall back on. Could always say, yeah, fine. But they never got me like we got her.
LaBute's second film, Your Friends and Neighbors, continued the battle of the sexes. And now his new piece, The Shape of Things, carries on this theme of how cruel men and women sometimes are to each other. It was adapted from a play. LaBute also writes and directs for live theater. And the couple at the center of this story are Adam, an undergrad, and Evelyn, an art student, played by Paul Rudd and Rachel Weisz.
You're cute. I don't like your hair.
Thanks. Can I call you?
Okay.
Why do you like me?
What?
Why would you like me? I'm not anything.
Don't worry about why, when what is right in front of you.
The Shape of Things is a modern-day Pygmalion, a sadistic My Fair Lady that explores relationships, of course, and also the meaning of art. So Here and Now producer Andrea Shea asked LaBute and leading man Paul Rudd to meet her at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston to talk more about the film, beginning with the plot.
The very, very quick version of it is a young man who meets a woman. In sort of Hollywood terms, they meet cute in a museum. And while they seem to be opposites, they end up striking up a relationship. And she is an outsider to this small university and small group of friends that are in the film. And this young man is quite smitten with her and is willing to change himself physically, emotionally, mentally, to fit her needs. And she drives a sort of wedge between he and his friends. And that is the more romantic side of it. And then there's a veneer of art over the piece as well about why people create art, why they're driven to do that, what is art, and how far art can go in the name of creating itself.
It's so hard to resist talking about the ending because it's just so remarkable and surprising. And, of course, we can't really talk about it here because we don't want to ruin it for people who are going to go out and see the film. But I guess I can cut to the chase and ask you something I've wanted to ask you for a long, long time, which is why make movies like In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors and now In the Shape of Things that are, in my opinion, they're really cruel?
I guess, frankly, just because I'm a cruel person and to get paid to be cruel, that's just icing on the cake. The reason is I'm interested in telling stories that are what would excite me as a viewer. I go to all kinds of films, and there's certainly enough, in my opinion, I won't even be joking and say my humble opinion, because it's not that humble, but I think there's so much of the other kind of material out there, what you would expect from Hollywood or television or the theater, that I'm drawn to seeing and telling things that are off the beaten track. And frankly, it's just quite interesting to write about. I'm not a documentarian, and while life is fascinating as well, I'm here to write about things that might happen or could happen or have the possibility of happening. I'm here to provide 2 hours of really interesting, hopefully offbeat entertainment. And so I'm a cross of P.T. Barnum and the Marquis de Sade.
It's true. I mean, that you really just take a big, huge magnifying glass and just stick women and men underneath it. Because you really are, in at least those three films I mentioned, looking at the ugly side of relationships.
I am, but I think there's a lot of frailty there as well. A lot of people that I would, you know, both in life and on the screen care about. As long as those people that I'm working with or writing about are interesting, that's all that matters to me. I'm under no obligation to coddle the audience or play to them to you know, try and make their lives more comfortable. If they see fit to come see something that I've done, they should know that they're going to be challenged in some way. That I think it's nice. I think an audience ultimately is just used to being played to, and I think they find it somewhat refreshing to have themselves be taken on a journey that surprises them.
Well, Paul Rudd, turning to you, audiences have seen you in lots of films. You know, one that might come to mind is Clueless with Alicia Silverstone. Here you're playing Adam, soft-spoken, shy, quiet guy in a brown corduroy blazer, and he's just amazed that a girl like Evelyn would be interested in him.
She's amazing, really.
What happened to your glasses? Are you wearing... No, Adam, are those contacts?
Yep, contacts.
Oh, my God. This from the former tape around the nose thingy champion.
Well, that was only for like a week, that one time.
I know, but still, you gotta admit.
I do. It's great. I feel better.
What did you think of the script and your role when you first saw it?
I was blown away when I first read the script and thought, one, that it was a really interesting and funny story and kind of beautifully brutal. And also in regard to the character, thought it would be a real challenge and unique experience to play a part that goes through such a change, both physically and emotionally.
Hey, I was actually expecting the nose and the extra flesh around your cheeks and neck when you walked in the door here. I wasn't sure it was you.
It was a combination of actually gaining weight, and then we shot the film in sequence, which isn't usually the case. And I went on a just hardcore diet of no carbs and that kind of thing, and worked out a lot and lost weight throughout the shoot, but then I also had some prosthetics in the early scenes. So it was kind of strange. It was strange to actually see the weight on me. Was pretty terrifying, actually.
Well, Neil, Rachel Weisz's performance was also amazing. She definitely has the upper hand in this relationship. Is this film and others about power?
I think I often write about power. The currency that we're often comfortable with in a relationship is power. How much someone loves you or you love them, and how that can be used for and against them. It's also just fun to write about, frankly. You know, it creates good characters who, and often they're very close-knit characters, husbands and wives or friends or co-workers who, for some inexplicable reason during the course of that piece, turn on one another. And that's a very fascinating thing, I think, to watch people betray one another who they've spent so much time with.
I've also got to ask, are you still a Latter-day Saint?
You can ask that, yes.
So how, and I know you've been asked this before, but how does the kind of ugliness of your films fit in with your religion?
You know, you're made up of so many things. I mean, that church informs a certain portion of my life, but also being a man and whatever political leanings I have and the age that I am, all those things inform, you know, my worldview. And while it, at times hard to rectify where the church is and where my writing is, I've been able to do it relatively well. Of course, I'm a great justifier, and they're less able to do that. So, you know, it's part of me, and yet there's so much of me to go around that I'm able to somehow find it in me to keep writing the way I see fit.
How do you expect audiences to react to the ending?
I hope they just weep and weep and weep. I hope they really can't leave the theater. They're so wrecked. You know I'm lying to you. You're shaking your head because you know I'm lying. You know, I hope they react in some way. It's hard to make people react today. There's so much out there that's on offer all the time. So many channels, so many movies. It's a very disposable culture we live in. And to have any influence for a matter of minutes or hours or if you're lucky, days, is a great thing. I hope they're surprised. I hope that it makes complete, if awful, sense to them. However, I'd rather have them hate it than be feeling, you know, mixed about it.
Well, thank you so much for meeting me here at the Museum of Fine Arts.
I'm very happy to have met you here in this Museum of Fine Arts.
And Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now producer Andrea Shea spoke with writer and director Neil LaBute and actor Paul Rudd about their new film, The Shape of Things.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
WBUR support.com. WBUR support.